Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the long-term impact of human beings' voracious appetite for fossil fuels? And how long will the choices we make today affect the environment our descendants have to live in? While many climate scientists struggle to predict the state of the warming planet over the next few decades, my guest today has set his sights on imagining how the Earth will function far into the future. Kurt Steiger is an ecologist, paleoclimatologist, and science writer who teaches at Paul Smith's College in New York. His new book is called Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. Kurt, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Start with this. What does a paleoclimatologist study?
Paleoclimatology is the study of climate history, basically. So we look at the long-term natural climate changes going back to ice ages and natural climate cycles.
And you're able to take that information and also extrapolate and imagine what things will look like in the future.
Absolutely. The basic principles that drove climate in the past are really not going to change. It's just that humans have joined forces with the natural processes as well.
When you are working with computer models of climate change, you talk about the fact that the length of time you're studying affects the accuracy with which you can predict the future. So knowing what the Earth will look like in 50 years is actually harder than 50,000.
Yeah, when you do the short-term stuff, you could say you're more interested in the weather, like is it raining on me or is it hot or cold around me? And those short-term kinds of things have a lot of randomness in it and very complex. So it is tough, actually, to predict exactly what the weather's going to be like, in a week or so. But if you look at the big, big picture and draw it with a really coarse general lines, you're basically relying on simple scientific common sense principles. And if you limit yourself to that, your conclusions can be pretty reliable. Just for an example, something like you can predict pretty reliably that the sun is going to rise in the east even 100,000 years from now. Mm-hmm. So it's those kinds of things that we're doing now with this long-term prediction.
But you write that we in the 21st century essentially have the power to set the thermostat for the planet for tens of thousands of years.
That's the most amazing thing. It's actually, I came across this research just a few years ago when the first research papers were coming out, and it just stunned me because I had been hearing about, what's climate going to be like in 2100 AD and sort of implying that it's kind of all over then, And at the worst, maybe it would last a few centuries. And when these new findings came out, it was just unbelievable. And I thought, well, now these are time scales that a climate historian like myself can really sink their teeth into. So just really started exploring what is this going to mean.
Have you always been comfortable as a scientist with those timescales? I mean, part of the problem, I think, for some of this, for the average person, is that we tend to think of things according to, the course of a human lifespan, and you can't limit yourself to that.
No, it takes practice, and I'll admit it's tough for me to really grasp some of these timescales on the gut level as well. So, listeners shouldn't feel like there's anything wrong with that. We're used to thinking on time frames and numbers that fit our daily life. So, for my students at Paul Smith College, a long time is waiting for the end of class or the end of the workday and things like that. But with practice, you can at least get your brain to wrap around it. And once in a while, if you keep at it, you can actually feel the reality of it as well.
Kurt, you have come to embrace this new term that describes our epoch, the Anthropocene. Can you talk about what convinced you that we had entered this time?
Yeah, I'd been hearing it sort of tossed around in the scientific literature and among my colleagues and all, and I started looking into it. I thought it was just kind of a funny joke because you use a technical term like that, and it sounds like the other geologic terms for, the age of the dinosaurs, let's say, the age of mammals, and we've got a sort of a system for that date back to the time of dinosaurs. Some names you might be familiar with, the Pleistocene epoch and the Eocene epoch and things like that, and they used the same kind of terminology and just said, well, if you go into the future and you look back at now, the signs we're going to see in the fossil record and the rock record is going to look just like those other time periods that are so distinct that it's going to need a new name. And so let's give it another geologic name and realize that we are in it right now and just starting it off.
And it's not just our bones that future generations will likely uncover. It's all the stuff we've built and thrown away.
There's going to be, you know, the trash layer and things like that. There are also going to be chemical signals. I mentioned some of them in the book, not necessarily even toxic ones, but just unique ones that are going to mark this time in the rock record. But the most dramatic thing, I fear, is not so much what we're going to leave behind, but what's going to be gone that's here now is when we lose so many species, not just from the climate changes alone, because species have survived those in the past. It's the combination of these kinds of changes with us in the picture blocking the species from migrating, let's say, or acidifying the oceans and things like that.
Yeah, so in the past, there weren't human cities in the way of things moving north or south, depending on where the food and water supplies were.
Right, and a lot of folks could, you know, try to make a case about this kind of a future and say, well, you know, we've had natural warmings in the past, so what's, you know, like, what's the big deal? And it is true, whether we have a relatively moderate future by cutting back on the fossil fuels or we burn all the stuff and make it as extreme as it could be, there have been cases in the distant past where people like me reconstructed, and yes, this has happened, but in those cases, animals and plants could migrate freely around the face of the earth. So when it was too hot here, you move somewhere else, or too wet or dry. The problem is going to be with humans in the picture in this Anthropocene or Anthropocene epoch, the age of humans, the world is a different place. We're in the picture, and it's like we're confining or blocking the free migration that would otherwise have let these living things adapt.
I was really interested to read this, that there are essentially two ways we can go. We can stop using carbon-based fuels very soon or use them all until we've entirely exhausted the Earth's supply. Either way, you think greenhouse gas concentrations will peak around the year 2400?
Yeah, the ballpark in there. That's when you try to pin the dates down exactly is where you might get a little, you know, a little bit of debate between the models. So someone might say 2200 AD, I think, is what a lot of models say for the peak if we do the moderate thing, if we switch quickly to non-carbon fuels, whereas if we just burn all the stuff, the change is actually going to be 5 to 10 times more severe. The peak, you could say, might start around 2400, but it's going to last for the peak itself will last for centuries, maybe thousands of years.
Hmm. And after the peak occurs, we still continue to see sea level rise and temperatures rising. Is that right?
Yeah, I came up with a term to try to capture that process. I call it climate whiplash, where we think of the global warming only now and forget that there is going to be a peak where, you know, we've only released that much CO2 and it's going to max out. And then it's going to flip into reverse, into cooling mode, and start dropping back. So our adaptations for a warming world will have to flip or whiplash into the negative or the cooling. But the other interesting thing about that turnaround time is not only will it be a time of dramatic change and reversals, but also the responses to that warming are going to be kind of in a staggered, delayed reaction, like a series of waves. Or I was likening it to a bunch of mountain climbers that are roped together, and one of them slips, and that tugs on the rope of their neighbor, and that then pulls them, and on down the line, one by one. So with the temperature peak, that will have reached its maximum and start to fall, but because it's so warm, the ice sheets will still be melting, and so the sea level will still be coming up. So it'll only be much later that the sea level will peak and eventually recover as well.
And when you describe that whiplash of global temperature, that doesn't really, it happens much faster than evolution would be able to keep up with it.
Well, I guess you could say those are the two most controversial scientific topics we could talk about, climate change and evolution. But if you talk about new species forming, yes, it would be the origin of new species is usually much slower than that. But if you talk about the other kind of evolution, we call it microevolution, where it's just the appearance or the physiology of something
sort of
changes.
Adaptations. Uh-huh.
Yeah, like an adaptation. Those things can happen sometimes overnight. So there will be a lot of that going on. It's just that, again, the rates of these changes are not all that unusual. So without us messing up the situation by being here, then I think a lot of the organisms could have adapted, unless there's something like a polar bear with no place to go.
So one of the things you do in your work is you go into lakes and you drill down really, really far and you find samples of mud and soil. Is that right?
Yeah, that's my specialty. It's we call it sediment coring, kind of like what some listeners might know about for maybe the better known ice cores that people drill through the ice sheets in Greenland and in Antarctica.
And what you can find essentially is that there are times when things that are now lakes were dry and times that they were different kinds of topography. Can you talk about sort of what evidence you find in this study particularly?
Sure. For someone like me, you see signs of massive environmental changes of the past pretty much everywhere. I live in upstate New York where there are just deposits everywhere from the last ice age. So we're kind of aware of what a really dramatic environmental change would be. And my main research is coring in lakes in Africa, in East Africa, and the world's largest freshwater lake, the main source of the Nile, is Lake Victoria in East Africa. It's the size of a small New England state, basically. That whole thing dried out 17,000 years ago, and you can tell that with my kind of work. It's kind of complicated, but you basically go out in the middle of the lake, and you drill down through, and you have this soft, wet muck stuff, and then suddenly you hit hard soil, like a hard pan, like miles and miles from shore. The only explanation is there was no lake there at one time from an intense drought that parched all of Africa and most of southern Asia.
So a lake that large being dried out 17,000 years ago certainly suggests that what we're coming up on here will really change the way world maps look.
Yeah. You can kind of take that information, and depending on your biases and your interests, you could sort of spin it both ways. Like, for example, I sometimes call myself a reformed climate skeptic because I was so used to those intensely dramatic changes from the droughts and the ice ages and such. When I saw charts of the warming we're causing now, I thought, well, you know, it could be a whole lot worse than that. What are we so worried about? So, again, the thing that really caught my attention was when this new research showed that the changes that we could easily decide to set in motion would be as severe as any of those natural changes in the past, and the situation for the other life forms on Earth will be far more serious because we're going to be in the picture.
You also, there were older models that said that we were due for our next ice age in about 50,000 years. And you think that because of the way we've used the planet thus far, human beings have pushed that back by 80,000 years?
Yeah, it's incredible. In fact, most of these things that are in the book are actually not even my research. They're coming from the peer-reviewed literature, and I'm sort of helping them leak out into the public at large. But these are well-known cycles, which, in fact, some folks who would deny that climate change is happening often refer to these. Well, they're well known, and you not only did they work in the past, you can run them into the future and see when they bring the next ice age or warming. And it's been well known that the next big one would be due in around 50,000 AD. And turns out, because the longevity of our fossil fuel emissions is so long, it's on par with nuclear radiation, actually. That by 50,000 AD, when the Earth would normally be heading into an ice age, we will have already left enough CO2 in the air to raise the temperature of the Earth just enough that we are going to prevent that ice age from even starting.
Even if CO2 levels peak, as you mentioned, in 2400 or before.
Absolutely. That's the best case scenario.
My guest is ecologist, paleoclimatologist, and science writer Kurt Steger. He teaches at Paul Smith's College in New York. His new book is called Deep Future, The Next 100 Years of Life, 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is paleoclimatologist and science writer Kurt Steiger. He teaches at Paul Smith's College in New York and is the author of the new book Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Kurt, when we talk about moving an ice age back by 80,000 years, that clearly sounds like a very big deal. You do take care to point out that an ice age is really, really bad for a lot of life forms on this planet, including human beings.
Absolutely. For me, this whole book project was a way to pull these ideas together, and I think people should realize that this information is pretty new, even for the scientific community, and we're really trying to come to grips with it, and what does it mean, and my first response to finding out that we've stopped the next ice age was horror that we're that powerful. And then pretty quickly, though, my old paleo self jumped in again and said, well, maybe that's not all bad. When you have an ice age, I mean, if you want to talk about environmental destruction, we worry about acid rain and different pollutants, but when you take a mile-thick slab of ice and completely bulldoze half a continent, and then let the ice sit there for tens of thousands of years, crushing everything, that's pretty total destruction. So you might say, well, gee, isn't that maybe one little bright side of, at least for the people in the far future, of what we might have done? It certainly doesn't counterbalance, though, the damage that we're going to be doing in the near term.
Mm-hmm. And you're not suggesting at all that we just willy-nilly use up all our carbon-based fuels and sort of bring it on.
No, I raised that as an ethical possibility. I mean, someone might say, well, we're supposed to worry about future generations, right? And, if we cut back on our fossil fuels, sure, we've stopped the next ice age, but there will be other cyclic ice ages after that. Shouldn't we do our descendants a favor by putting even more CO2 in the air so this lasts for half a million years and stops even more ice ages? And I would hope that people don't take that as, a viable strategy for what we should be doing now. But it's a really interesting just scientific question of, oh, my gosh, look at that.
And you've talked about the importance of maybe leaving some fossil fuels behind in exactly that case, that maybe an ice age was impending. And at that point, they could use that carbon to raise the climate.
Yeah, it's again, it was a little bit tongue in cheek, but it's also true. It's to think on these timescales really kind of makes you look at everyday things a little bit differently. And right now, we look at coal as something to run a furnace on or a factory or to heat your house with. But in this really long term view, the biggest use of the coal or the biggest effect is not to heat your house, but to heat the whole planet with the gases it makes, and really to affect climate. So if you put yourself in the shoes of people 50,000 years from now, or in this next case now, it's going to be 130,000 years when the next one's coming, maybe those people, if they have a culture that lets them know what's going on in that far future, they may say, well, gosh, we don't want to be bulldozed by an ice sheet. I wish we had some coal that we could burn just enough of to put a little more CO2 in the air, warm the earth up, and stop this one too. So I was sort of saying, well, gee, maybe that's just one more reason to do the right thing, is if we switch to non-carbon fuels for many other good reasons, then we'll have left that stuff sequestered naturally in the ground as it already is, just waiting for future generations to make their own decisions as to whether they may want to use it for its higher purpose, you could say, which would be to use it as ice age insurance.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also join us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phones now to Ron in Terrell. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I was wondering if he is familiar with some of the studies that have been done in Israel in regards to the pan evaporation rates and the effect of man's pollutants being thrown into the air and precipitation. And I'd like to have his thoughts on that, because I know that some scientists believe that's going to push us into a more of a global warming, whereas it almost contradicts itself by some of the studies. And I'd be willing to listen to his comments on that.
Oh, sure. Would you mind filling me in a little bit more about what about that pan evaporation you were concerned about?
Well, it just seems to me that many of the scientists, because when you have a cloud formation, you have to have a certain amount of debris that's put up into the atmosphere to form clouds. And if we're heading into what they're saying is global warming, but pollution and some of the studies that we've seen from, like, whenever 9/11 took place and the absence of contrails over America and the change of what it's done to the environment, do these pollutants that we're throwing up there also affect all of this? That it's almost like the world is almost or has the ability to overcome what we do to it.
Well, let's get an answer for you. Thanks for your call.
Sure. No, those are very good points. Those effects of our pollutants and all, just things like soot and stuff like that and dust, are absolutely important climate variables. There's also the output of the sun, too. We often think of the sun as being constant, but the amount of energy coming out of that does change through time, and that's what's driven climate changes in the past. It's just that we're in addition to that. And as you suggested, where some people, not so much now in the science community anymore, but people say, well, you know, how could we possibly overwhelm those forces? And in fact, from the best studies we have now, those were the dominant causes of the warming trend until about 30 or 40 years ago. We've been monitoring all of those natural processes, and they've really pretty much leveled off and sort of flatlined since the 60s or 70s. So they should not be making it get any warmer, but it has absolutely been getting warmer, and the only other thing going up with it is the CO2, and we know that's us.
So, Kurt, even the scientists most concerned about the imminent impact of global warming have conceded that there would be some places that would be better off in terms of human existence. You know, you can sail across the North Pole and you'll have summer vacation in Greenland, which is actually green. And but talk about this. What happens to the places that are already incredibly hot and dry on this planet right now?
Yeah, well, there are some things that are easier to predict than others. And if you make the general statements, you're safer than if you do the specifics. So what we can say with pretty solid certainty is that it will get warmer pretty much everywhere. The big mysteries are, what's the rainfall going to do? And rainfall is much more difficult to study. It's got to do with things like the dust and the pan evaporation and all those kinds of things, and where are the winds taking it. So most of the models and kind of common sense and the climate history, the sort that I do, suggest that probably most of the tropics will get warmer and wetter, because there'll be more moisture in the air from all the evaporation, and the heat will make the air circulate more, and you'll get more rain. Then other places you could kind of predict are probably going to get drier. And one likely place is the northern part of the Sahara Desert and anything along that latitude, because we know about atmosphere circulation systems there, and that should intensify. So it's going to be a patchwork. There will be winners and losers. And you have to be really careful, because we're humans with feelings and the ability to make choices. What would normally have been just mechanical, natural, automatic changes now have ethical components, because we're choosing to do them. So even if certain places, like, let's say, Greenland might, you could argue, benefit, or people that want to sail over the North Pole would benefit, the fact that you would harm other people really complicates the issue.
I think the most terrifying single set of facts in the book, Kurt, relates to the state of the oceans if we continue adding carbon to our environment. Can you talk a little bit about what you expect might happen?
Yeah, that's the real scary story. If I'm not so much a doom and gloom type of guy, and I do make the case in the book that humankind will pull through, I believe, even though we lose some species. But to me, the most depressing side of the story is not the climate so much. That's eventually, even over thousands of years, will eventually recover in the sea levels. The big difference is going to be the chemistry of the oceans, and we just don't hear so much about that. And it's basically, the term is ocean acidification, and that just refers to the carbon dioxide leaving the air, and therefore that's how we are going to recover. A lot of the CO2 is just going to dissolve in the oceans, and at first you think, well, isn't that great? It's like a little storm sewer, you know, that's going to wash away our pollution. Yeah, well, it doesn't really go away. It just goes into the oceans. Mm-hmm. And when it does, it makes a weak acid called carbonic acid, and the more that goes in, the more it disrupts the ocean chemistry in ways which we're already measuring that can actually make it really difficult to be an animal living in the ocean that has a hard part, like a shell, like a clam or a crab or coral reefs, anything that could dissolve in an acid like that. In parts of the world, we already see them starting to dissolve. And we could make, you know, arguments, oh, well, some parts of the world might benefit from the warming, and or later on, you know, they may be glad we stopped an ice age. I don't know of any bright side or benefit to ocean acidification when we start losing these species.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Ronald in Austin. Hi, Ronald.
Hello, yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hello. I was wondering what studies have been done regarding the deforestation of the rainforest over that's been happening, and perhaps if we started vast reforestation process, even though it's economically possible because people make their livings on the...
Ronald, I'm so sorry. We have a really poor connection. I'm going to try and paraphrase what I think I understood from your question. Kurt, I don't know how much you were able to hear. He was talking about the state of the rainforest, as we might imagine it, in the future as the planet continues to warm.
Yeah. That's a complicated question. It's something that we call a feedback situation, where if you change one aspect of the environment, that sets things in motion that amplify that change, kind of like taking a snowball and rolling it down a hill. Well, you're down in Texas. You don't have lots of snowballs, but we think of that. You roll a snowball down the hill, and it picks up more snow and gets bigger.
Tumbleweed gathers dust around here.
What is it?
A tumbleweed will gather dust.
There you go. Okay, so think of the tumbleweeds. And so the big fear is if we continue cutting down large areas of forest, that in itself is part of what makes it rain or get warm or cold and things like that. And the more you cut the forest down, basically, the drier you're likely to make the habitat, which then makes more of the forest dry out. So that's one of the big fears. Like if you go, let's say, south of you folks into the Caribbean, you see a lot of the islands down there that are, like I used to work down in the Turks and Caicos, and they're these desert islands. They didn't used to be. They used to have forest, and it used to rain, and there was drinking water. But once those were cut for firewood and other things, those feedback processes happened, and it became even more dry and then permanently dry. So those are the kinds of fears we're going to have for the rainforest probably too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll go next on the phones to George in Dallas. Hi, George.
Hi. I'm an archaeologist, and I was wondering what his feelings are about the carrying capacity for human populations in the long run, because pretty obviously if you look at the past 200 years or so, the human population has gone through like an algae because of the Industrial Revolution and the use of petroleum. But do you think we'll return perhaps to the much lower Neolithic or very low, less than a billion people on the planet or even less? I was just wondering what his feelings were about carrying capacity for humans.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Kurt?
Yeah, that's a really tough one. If you think predicting climate is tough, try to predict what people are going to do just even over the course of a year. I mean, look at the political and social changes we have going on overseas right now. So I just have personal feelings and ideas about this. And when I envision what people are going to do, first of all, I'm convinced there's very little that could really kill every last person off. People are going to experience these changes we're setting in motion. But the kind of lifestyle and the numbers of people will probably depend on how much civilization or culture or technology we have. So maybe to paint it in broad brush terms, when I'm sort of daydreaming about this, I think, well, maybe we'll continue on the path we are now, where we're so interconnected and so technology dependent. If we manage to get along with each other and we don't trash the environment too much, and we don't kill each other too much, we can support large numbers of people, and that might be a future to look forward to. On the other hand, if we kill each other off a lot, then I think the carrying capacity of the land will change, because we won't have the high-tech farming and big distribution networks. So I think our numbers are going to depend more on what we do to each other than what the climate does.
Obviously, human beings compete for resources, and we've talked about the presence of humans in what was once purely plant and animal habitat. But plants and animals also compete for resources. And will there be a great shift, do you think, of the number of species, the biodiversity of particular areas, as there is less and less land to support them?
Yeah, absolutely. The change in the biodiversity is going to be the least reversible of all of these changes. You can raise a sea level, and then as the temperature falls back down, the sea level will eventually fall back down too. But when you wipe out a species, it's gone for good. And as we were talking about evolution, if we think 100,000 years is a long time, it certainly is on the scale of our lifetime, but not for evolution. So for all intents and purposes, extinction, I would say, is forever. And so in my darker moments, I fear that what we're going to see in this rising and then falling temperature and sea level world is we're going to see a steady decline in the number of species. Because, like you said, there's the competition in addition to us blocking them off or killing them off. When we spread other competitors around the world, they outcompete species as well.
Ecologist and paleoclimatologist Kurt Steger is my guest. His new book is called Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. We will get to more of your calls after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kurt Steger. He's an ecologist, paleoclimatologist, and professor at Paul Smith's College in New York. His new book is called Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Josh in Fort Worth. Hi, Josh.
Oh, I wanted to ask him if there would be parallels between this phase of global warming and mass extinctions and things like that in the past, specifically the Permian end event, where you had what it sounds like similar things happening, where continents dried out and the result was 90% of all species died out. Also, I'd like to ask him if he ever, in his book, factored in the repercussions of, say, a nuclear war in terms of climate.
Great. For the first one about this Permian extinction, that's as far as we know in the fossil record, it's the biggest mass extinction ever. And there's still arguments about what caused it. There were certainly probably climatic things that happened during that time, but to really kill off that many species, like you say, more than 90%, you needed other things, and it's possibly maybe asteroid. Most likely it was massive toxic air pollution from intense volcanic activity that lasted for thousands of years. So what we're looking at here, our air pollution is not as corrosively intense as that. And most of those kinds of changes we're going to be setting in motion will have to do with the warming and, of course, the ocean acidification, too. So we did have something since that big extinction of 55 million years ago, which was a super greenhouse, super hothouse, much like our worst-case future scenario. And most animals on land and most plants on land pulled through just fine because they could move. There were some extinctions in the oceans from the acidification that happened. I think that we're likely to see mass extinctions, but not just from the climate. It's more the direct effects of us, the hunting and the habitat destruction. And as far as the nuclear war goes, maybe including, would we be wiped out? I, with my fingers crossed and not being an expert and of course, never knowing exactly what people are going to do, my feeling is that it's unlikely that we're going to kill each other off with nuclear war. But people have done studies you may actually be familiar with. Maybe that's why you raised the question. There were studies that showed if we have the all-out nuclear war, the dust going in the air and the soot and the moisture going up there would make something called a nuclear winter, which would darken the skies and cool the earth off and add to our woes. So let's just hope we don't go down that route as well.
I want to talk about this, and it's not so much in the book, but there's been a new wave of concern. We talked about nuclear power being something that would not put carbon into the air, and then there's the Japanese disaster. What sort of hope is there for emerging technologies that use fuels like thorium instead of uranium?
Yeah. I used to protest nuclear power in college back in the 70s, so that's where I was coming from. And I've never liked it much, especially because of the unsolved problem of where to put the waste. And It's actually the waste that, if I understand it right, that's the biggest problem in the Japan situation right now is not so much what was going on in the core, which was all well protected, but it was the waste packed around it on shelves, basically, that causing trouble. So when fellow environmental types started saying that this global warming is so serious that we've got to go to nukes as a way to get rid of the CO2 emissions, I thought, well, what happened to these people? They've gone over to the dark side. You know? I still kind of feel that way about regular nukes, but by accident, a colleague of mine started mentioning these, what you mentioned, the thorium reactors, which I had never heard of, and I urge listeners to try to find out about this stuff. The short version of what thorium nuclear power is, or the so-called green nukes, which you can look up on Google under that word, it's basically they can't melt down the way. Hello?
Yeah, are you there? Oh, we lost you for a second, but we've got you.
I got excited and pressed the phone against my face. And I get excited by this because it's a real ray of hope. They can't melt down. The waste is relatively short-lived and benign. You can't use them to make weapons. And most unbelievably is they can actually burn up the nasty waste left over not only from the traditional nukes that we're having trouble storing, but also from our weapons programs.
There's a pretty good article from Wired magazine about 2 years ago that I happened to find just this morning as I was reading up on this in preparation for the show, so people may be able to find it there.
Yeah, I've been blogging about it, too, on just write in green nukes or energy from thorium. Just go and Google that. There's actually a web discussion group with a lot of the nuclear engineers. It's called Energy from Thorium. And just go check it out. It's still mostly the engineers talking about it, and a lot of them, you kind of feel like they're almost evangelical about it. I'd like to have, like, regular folks, like all the rest of us, also look at it and see, is it too good to be true? And is there a dark side? And if so, what is it? Because if it's as good as it sounds, this could be the answer to all of our problems.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we have Kelly on the line in Dallas. Hey, Kelly.
Hi. I've got a two-part question. The first is I'm interested in your thoughts on the Atlantic conveyor current and any effects it might have on Northwestern Europe. And secondly, Is there any analogous mechanism in the Pacific or anything else that can give us some predictions about what might happen to the temperate rainforests in the Pacific, Northwest Pacific U.S.?
Sure. There's been a lot of talk in recent years about changing the ocean currents. And if you shut down the Gulf Stream and such in the Atlantic, that you could send Europe into a deep freeze. And that has been blown out of proportion into, you know, movies and things like that, disaster flicks. This is a real phenomenon. It happened in the past, and that's how it came to our attention, is back at the end of the last ice age, for example, when we had tons of ice in North America and Europe. Huge amounts of that stuff melted and collapsed into the North Atlantic, shut the currents down, and set the world back into an ice age for 1,000 years. So it's such a dramatic story that the reason most of us are not too worried about it now is, first of all, there's not that much ice left. Most of it has collapsed. And so we hear about Greenland melting, and that's certainly true, but probably not enough to shut the currents down. And most of the models now, or analyses that are done, suggest that if it happens at all, any climate effects from the current disruptions, the warming of our greenhouse gases will far outweigh that and just cover it all up. So we won't even notice it. So I wouldn't worry about that too much. As far as the Pacific mechanisms go, I'm not as familiar with that. I know the moisture for the Pacific Northwest rainforest does come off the Pacific and on the westerlies and all. And again, the currents there, I don't think, are going to be exposed to big pulses of meltwater that are likely to shut that down.
It does strike me, Kurt, that for a scientist who is concerned with things that have happened so far into the past and so will happen so deep into the future, there's a lot of sort of day-to-day stuff you have to keep up with in terms of our developing understanding of how all this works.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating, actually. I mean, if you're an ecologist, you're supposed to learn about animals, plants, rocks, chemicals, everything. And if you're a paleo-ecologist, it's everything that happens in the world all at once and that ever happened in the past.
Hmm.
So if you're really the inquisitive, kind of nerdy type like I am, it's just a wonderful playground.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Sean in Dallas. Hey, Sean.
Hey, thanks for the call. I was curious if the author considered advancements in technology such as algae that might be a CO2 scrubber, and then also advancements in science as far as storing and returning animals someday in the future, such as the Mammoth Project.
Yeah, those are two really interesting things. I tried to stay away from the technology so much because it's really not my field, and some of it's speculative in the book, and I was mainly sticking with the climate, but it's just fascinating ideas people have. So you're right, there's the technology with the algae and CO2 consumption. There's ideas of using artificial photosynthesis to split water and make hydrogen to make hydrogen fuel. So it's, as I said, I don't consider this all doom and gloom. I think these technologies are just emerging, and it's a really hopeful time that if we pay attention to these, they could take us down the right path. As far as the restoring of the mammoths and stuff, I think it's a really interesting idea. With someone like me, we consider the lack of woolly mammoths and things in North America is artificial, that what looks like a pristine wilderness out here has actually been manipulated. And so I'm not sure how, having worked in Africa around elephants, I'm not so sure whether I really would like to have mammoths and mastodons running around in my backyard anymore. But it's just a really fun thought.
It's amazing to think that we could do it. I'm not sure whether we should do it simply because we can, but it's fascinating to consider.
Yeah, it's just incredible. I think the biggest takeaway I get out of this whole project of talking about the deep future was just to realize the power we have over the world. Most of our history, we were just another species kind of getting pushed around by climates and other things. And now, with our numbers and our technology and our interconnected awareness, we have become a force of nature that decides what lives where and what the world is like. So to me, it's kind of like I liken this awareness of our place in deep time and with this power, kind of the way I felt when I saw the first pictures of the Earth from space.
Hmm.
from the moon. It's just transformative to see how important we are in the grand sweep of history.
And yet it's so hard to convince ourselves that individual actions make that much of a difference.
Yeah, well, it's really important now. The people that are alive on the Earth today and for the rest of this century, we are more interconnected than humans have ever been before or anything has been before in the world. And so our ideas and the way we think spread, and they support massive changes that can happen almost overnight. So just learning about the world makes you part of this amazing force of nature, and you can actually, you don't have to be the rocket scientist who comes up with the technology, but you can be the one that supports it and tells other people about it. So maybe just to sum it up, I just heard a quote from a scientist from the 1800s, Thomas Huxley. He said, "We need to find out what is true so we can do what is right." And I think that's the best thing we can do.
I think we have time for one more phone call this afternoon. We'll go to Steve in Euless. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Chris. Great guest. Kurt, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. My concern, I'll be brief, is methane, and I'm not talking about from the cows. I'm talking about from the tundra, and I'm also talking about the methane that's in the continental shelves. That what is the tipping point temperature-wise where that stuff erupts from the continental shelves and then all of a sudden acidifies the oceans? Go for it.
Thanks.
Absolutely.
For your call.
That's the big fear. All the more reason to cut back now. There is a tipping point between what we've done now and that massive runaway greenhouse, and it's just what Steve was saying. There's methane buried in the tundra. There's frozen methane under the oceans. And as we warm the oceans and the tundra, that stuff will start coming out and adding to the sum total of the greenhouse gases. We don't know exactly where that tipping point is. We know we haven't crossed it yet, and let's just hope we don't.
You described yourself earlier as a converted climate skeptic. Can you talk about why you think so much of the rest of the world is still so polarized over this topic?
Well, most of the regular folks that I talk to that call themselves skeptics, I prefer to call it deniers because as a scientist, you're supposed to be skeptical. I don't see anything wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the ones I know are sincere. They have real questions and stuff doesn't make sense. And when you explain it, they say, oh, yeah, I guess that does make sense. But I'm sure everybody listening to this knows that there are other things besides sincere questioning and science going on. There are agendas here. And I think a lot of what's going on is trying to confuse people.
Do you have hope that your students will understand this, that generation of Americans?
Well, excuse me?
Do you have hope for the generation of students that you're teaching right now, that this generation will get the importance of taking care of the planet?
Oh, absolutely. My students certainly do. It's so exciting to watch them. And they're not just taking things on faith either. They're thinking for themselves. They're learning as much as they can, and they're talking among themselves, and they're more hopeful for the future, I think, than my generation was back in the 60s.
That's the best thing I've heard all day. Kurt Steiger is the author of the new book, Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. Kurt, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.